This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
You're very much going to enjoy tonight's speaker. So we have a rare beast with us this evening. We have Robert Abbott, and he is a venture capitalist. You actually have a statistically better chance of playing professional baseball than you do of becoming a venture capitalist. There's fewer venture capitalists than there are professional baseball players. And I always like to say that because I loved baseball, and I never made it as a professional. So Robert joined Norwest Venture Partners. This says Northwest. In 1998. And that's a long time in the venture world. A lot of changes have happened to the venture community in 1998. So it's nice to have that kind of perspective on the investment scene. He's on the board of a number of companies right now. In the past, some of the companies he's been involved with include Occam Networks. You guys have heard of that, as well as Kayak. And some of the companies that he was on the board of were acquired by companies such as Dell, Kayak again, and Princeton Review. So that's typical of the venture capital game. You'll invest in a smaller company, and oftentimes it'll be acquired by a larger company. Maybe it'll go public. Robert has 9 years of operational experience. He is my kind of venture capitalist. And I actually think that's the newer model of venture capital, is someone who didn't come up through investment banking, didn't come up through consulting, actually came up with hands-on experience building and growing companies. And Robert is no exception to that. His experience ranges from engineering to marketing to product management, which, again, I think is helpful as an investor when you can understand more than one facet of a business. Because as a board member, you're looking at all the facets of a business, not just your area of expertise. Some of the companies he worked for when he was an operator included Silicon Graphics as well as IBM. So Robert holds a Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Science in Electrical Engineering, as well as an MBA, and he earned all of those from a little-known school, you might not have heard of it, Stanford. All right, let's welcome Robert to our class.
Great. Well, thanks for having me the nice introduction. So we have a lot to cover. I'm going to cover a number of different topics, and hopefully at least one or two of them will resonate with you guys. First off, just a quick agenda. I'll give you a little bit more about my background and how I got to where I am, and a little bit about Norwest. Then what kind of the quick snapshot of the venture industry, you know, what it's like today. The kind of the areas that we're looking at from an investment perspective, and in some of our thoughts around, you know, if you're starting a company, what are kind of the key things you want to look for, and then one last slide on just a little bit of, you know, career advice that is worth what you pay for. So so a little bit about myself. As was mentioned, I got my bachelor's and master's in EE at Stanford. I decided to get my master's in EE because when I finished my bachelor's, I kind of felt like I knew a lot about very little. And so I got my master's, and I had an emphasis at that time in the late 80s. It was all about computer architecture and CPUs and things of that nature. And so I kind of specialized more in the CPU RISC processors and things of that nature. And then I went to work briefly at IBM Rome, and actually I didn't really like it that much because IBM was a huge company, and somebody in like Atlanta had to kind of, you know, who had knew nothing about my products, had to sign off on things. And anyway, one thing led to another, and I ended up going to Silicon Graphics, where I had worked during the summer while I was there. And one of the things I should say is when I came out of my master's, and I got my master's right after my bachelor's, I didn't actually want to go straight into engineering. So I actually went into product planning at IBM because I felt like I knew how to kind of translate technology into more commercial terms or easier to understand terms. So I went into product planning, but when I went back to Silicon Graphics, I went into engineering, and then through my career there, which is about 7.5 years, I went from engineering and then into product management and product marketing. So I was able to work with manufacturing, sales, the engineering, and not so much a little bit with finance, but mostly with the main disciplines, which I think has helped me tremendously to understand businesses as a venture capitalist, being able to understand the go-to-market, the engineering issues, being able to call BS on engineers on their schedules and things like that, having lived with them and watch them miss their schedules and things like that. So, but when I was at Silicon Graphics, there was a period of time where I was kind of like, and for those of you who aren't familiar with Silicon Graphics, because it was in its day, one of the high-flying companies in Silicon Valley in the early 90s and into mid-90s. But we were doing 3D graphics computers, so basically a visualization of anything. And we had a lot of Jurassic Park, a lot of movies were using, studios were using us for the animations that they were creating, car companies, national labs were all using our computers. And we, at that time, President Clinton came in and visited us. That was probably the beginning of the end, because that's how we knew we were so important that we got too full of ourselves, I think. But anyway, I didn't want to become the 3D graphics person. And so I started thinking about what would I do to broaden my horizons, be able to go into different disciplines and do something different. And I talked to a lot of friends and people in the industry. And I was interested in venture capital because I had grown up in Silicon Valley. My father was part of an earlier startup in the medical device. And so I just had kind of that exposure. And I really liked the idea of working with entrepreneurs and lots of different technologies. And kind of everybody came back and said, well, maybe you should go get your MBA and then figure out what you want to do from there. So I went back, applied to business school with the idea that I would either move into venture capital or go to a startup, and I'd go out of the, kind of the computer graphics business and look at something else. And that was right at the time, Netscape was just being formed by Jim Clark, who was the founder of Silicon Graphics originally, and so there's a lot of stuff going on in that kind of 1996 time frame. Anyway, so I came out of business school, and I was fortunate enough to be able to have my summer job in between years of business school to be at Norwest Venture Partners, and then they offered me a job and as an associate. And then over the course of the last 15 years, moved from associate to principal to partner, and working with a lot of great entrepreneurs and companies, and have really enjoyed that. It's been a long and unique kind of career in Silicon Valley, in the sense that most of the people I know have not really worked for only two companies. They've worked for, five or six. Out of my business school class, I'm probably one of just a handful of people that have been in the same job since leaving business school, so for 15 years. Anyway, so that's a little bit about me and my background. I want to give you a quick commercial on Norwest Venture Partners. So we've been around for over 50 years doing venture investing. We're a global fund, so we have offices in India and Israel and in Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. And we are investing out of our 11th fund, which is a $1.2 billion fund. And we invest across lots of different sectors. Here's a few of the companies that we're invested in today. And hopefully some of them are names that you know. Some you may or may not know. But we invest across what I call the enterprise, which is infrastructure and software. We have healthcare IT services, and then more of the consumer-oriented e-commerce types of things. Again, some of which you may know. RetailMeNot recently went public, and if you ever are looking for a coupon on the web, these are the guys that usually serve those up. We have FireEye, which is a security company went public recently. So lots of across the spectrum of IT and consumer is kind of where we invest. You know, one of the things that, we like to focus on when we work with companies is, you know, how do we help them? How do we add value? Can we add value? And the things that we try to do is, you know, always help with strategy, try to help find great, you know, executives to bring in to support the entrepreneurs. We always look for innovative technology. And then we help try to introduce those companies to potential partners and customers. So we'll have, say, you know, the CIO of a large, you know, financial institution come in and meet, you know, our enterprise infrastructure companies and storage and networking and security as a way to help business development for that company. We also do help them with some marketing, you know, their press releases, you know, finding the right PR firm for them, and trying to work through and make sure that they have all of the, you know, kind of pieces that they need and services and people to try to create a successful business. Because in the end, it's all about the people in general. You know, what do we look for? We always look for something that has a large market that can be an independent, standalone company. Even though most companies get acquired, it's more the exception that they go public as opposed to you know, getting acquired. So most companies get acquired, and we like to see them be able to build a $50 to $100 million, you know, revenue kind of business. Which is something that we believe, you know, ultimately can be profitable and sustainable. And if we partner with these companies to build these types of businesses, we believe in the end we'll create value for, you know, the people that have entrusted us with the money to invest and give them a good return. You know, strong founding team is super important. You know, domain expertise in especially in the enterprise sector is very important. You know, it's hard to you know, we wouldn't really back a security company if the person didn't come out of, you know, having been at a security company before in that domain somehow, just because they have better insights into both the technology and typically what the customers are looking for. And then we look for, you know, customer validation. We like to see, you know, companies even in their very earliest stages, even pre-product, you know, where they've gone out and they've solicited input from the customers. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on as well. But it's super important to get customer validation. And then the last is you know, our ideal is companies that can, you know, do all this stuff and not take a lot of capital and be very capital efficient. But it's tough in different environments, and different types of technologies require more capital than others. As an example, semiconductor companies tend to take a lot of capital to get to the point where they have revenue and things, because building a chip is expensive, and on top of that, you've got to, once you build that chip and it works, then you have to get your customer to build it into their products. You're going through yet another design cycle, so you're burning cash through all that time, and then that finally gets into the market and you start to sell. So you end up with kind of two development cycles, and that takes more capital. So just a quick snapshot on the venture industry. One thing to note is that, you know, in the grand scheme of asset allocation for institutions and pension funds and things like that, where they look to put money, venture capital is a very small piece of that asset allocation. And as you can see here, you know, $200 billion is kind of the total assets under management, and it's just dwarfed by, you know, buyout funds, hedge funds, mutual funds, everything else. So, it's a very, in some ways, for, you know, the job creation and the innovation, it's very efficient. But there's not a lot of capital. Even though sometimes I feel like there's too much capital based on my competing for other deals and things like that. But overall, it's a pretty small part of the asset allocation for pension funds and other institutions. The interesting thing is when I got into the business in 1998, you know, things were booming. We had the internet boom, and pets.com and things like that, and lots of companies that didn't survive. And a lot of venture capital firms didn't survive either. So the industry is about half what it was in terms of venture firms that are active today compared to in 2000. And that contraction is actually good. It's good for entrepreneurs and it's good for investors, because when too many companies get funded in the same space, it dilutes the opportunity for everybody. You know, it's harder to find good people. It's harder to sell to customers, because the customers can drive down prices through the competition. So it's always, it's kind of nice if you can get into a business where there's not as much competition and you can get your pick of all the best people. But the good news is that, you know, we in the venture capital industry, we continue to invest. I would say the pace of investment that I see today is just as rapid and great as it was in 99, which for those of you, you probably don't really know at the time because you were young, but it's there's a lot going on. There's a lot of innovation. I think we're in a big wave of technological change. And that's fostering a lot of new businesses. The other thing that's different over time is that the cost to start a business is much, much cheaper today than it was 10 years ago. With things like Amazon and their web services, the software tools and capabilities that are available, it's much, much easier to start at least a software company on a much less capital than it was 10 or 15 years ago. You know, but the thing to remember is there's lots of sources of funding as you start a company and look for funding. You know, there's friends and family, there's angels, there's debt. If you can get a product out into the market and you can get some revenue, you can typically get some debt on top of that. You know, there's corporate investment for ideas that are very closely tied to certain corporations. So there's lots of different avenues of funding a business. It's not just, you know, a lot of people think just venture capital is the way to go, and that's the only way I can go to get my business started. And a lot of times, you know, I've had entrepreneurs come to me, and I've said, you know, you don't want to raise venture capital. The type of business that you're creating and the type of exit you're going to have, if you take, pick a number, $5 million from me versus all you really need is $1 or $2 million, I'm going to expect a much bigger exit than the company might warrant than if you were to just take a little bit less capital and run it efficiently from there. So what are we looking at today? As I kind of showed in the very beginning there, you know, we focus on, you know, the enterprise, which is the cloud and IT infrastructure. So that includes big data, includes storage, networking, mobile management, you know, semiconductors. You layer on top of that software applications, across the enterprise to do, you know, financial management, marketing automation, manufacturing automation. So all those things that focus on business-to-business selling, we look at all those IT opportunities, and I'll tell you a little bit more in a minute. And then, of course, for us as a firm, we also look across the internet and consumer technology, so e-commerce, media, gaming. You know, one of our companies, which you guys may be aware of, is called Lumosity. Lumos Labs, and they do these brain games that help you remember, you know, things and be sharper in class. So, but and then ad technology. You know, how do you serve ads that are appropriate for the person that's watching or looking at the page or the video? And then we look at communication services, and then healthcare IT. And we actually think healthcare IT, which I won't talk so much about, but is a big area of a focus, because the healthcare industry has been so far behind in their adoption of technology that there's a lot of opportunity for them to kind of leapfrog one or two generations to today and have much more efficient, you know, businesses. So we have companies that are in those spaces too. So. Specifically, though, the enterprise is changing. I was talking about some of these waves of technologies, and what's happening is that the inmates are in control. And what do I mean by that? Is that employees and customers are bringing technology into the businesses that the IT manager makes it very hard for them to manage and keep secure. So it started about 10 years ago with Wi-Fi. If you think about Wi-Fi, all of a sudden, it's all ubiquitous today. But back 10 years ago, it was not very well deployed. And engineers would start bringing in and popping up their own Wi-Fi networks, but they're all totally unsecure. So anybody could go near the company, log into that Wi-Fi network, and get to access to all the corporate secrets and technologies. So, and then more recently, with things like Amazon Web Services, engineers are putting workloads of proprietary things up into the public cloud that are also unsecured and not managed. And the same with Dropbox and Box. Marketing people are putting presentations out there that shouldn't be available to the public or that are not as well secured. And so all these technologies are creating a nightmare for the IT managers to keep mostly it's around security and not letting information get out of the walls of the corporation into the hands of competitors or countries or whatever it might be that are looking for that. The other kind of big big change that we've seen is the smartphone. Mobile phones and the smartphones that probably most of you have are really changing the way that people interact with corporate data and with their customers and everything else. And so that's changing a lot as well. So we're seeing companies that want to do mobile device management. How do I, as a corporation, make sure that when somebody brings in their phone and they're doing their personal stuff and their work stuff on it, how do I make sure that that's not all going out? They're not getting commingled and compromised in some fashion. And so, and kind of all all that kind of speaks to one of the big problems that we've seen, which we didn't see 10, 15 years ago, is security is becoming much more important. 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, it was a nice to have. People didn't, think they needed to have much security. But what they all wanted was something that, when we look at businesses, they all want something that increases revenue or decreases costs. But security has become super important these days because you have not just, the hackers have become more sophisticated, but are trying to make money off of your social security number or your credit card number and hacking into those things, but also just corporate data, and you have again countries that are trying to infiltrate companies, and so security has become much more of an important area for us. And the thing about security is it's an arms race. There isn't one solution that solves it. The bad guys keep figuring out ways to punch holes into networks, and so there's constantly this escalation of solutions to try and thwart them. The other thing that we're seeing on the somewhat on the consumer side is the whole share economy, which I'm sure you're familiar with if you use Zipcar and these types of things, where people are doing much more around sharing of services and solutions so that they can be more efficient, use less money to do certain things. Instead of buying a car, you can basically share it or rent it. So you see things like Uber kind of disrupting the taxi industry. So there's a lot of change going on there. And when we look at, and I've talked most about these already, but when we look at kind of the macro trends, bring your own device is disrupting the enterprise, and it's a big wave that's coming through. How do I make those devices, more efficient for me as an employee to be able to do my work faster than just having to sit at my desktop in front of my computer? SaaS applications, so software as a service. So again, instead of having an application that is behind the company's firewall and located on the company's premises, it's in the cloud. It can be much more easily managed and provisioned. And I have to have, as a company, less resources to get that technology up and running. I mentioned security, which is kind of a constant challenge. You know, the whole advent of the cloud for both compute and storage is really going to change the dynamics of businesses and how they operate, because you have companies like Amazon who can drive the cost of computing and storage down to such low levels that it just makes sense as a business to start to use those services than to try to build and manage your own. And that's why it's one of the things I was saying, just even for startups, you know, the ability to be able to go to Amazon and not have to buy a computer but just rent compute cycles is just changing the dynamics of how much it costs to get a business up and running. And these things are all impacting the enterprise as well. API is really about how do applications and services talk to each other. And it used to be that special software and companies even were built around creating, you know, links between different, you know, financial services applications and HR applications and customer support applications. And now, with the advent of APIs, you know, it makes these connections much more seamless and easier to connect to. Big data, you probably all have heard about, you know, how much Google and Facebook and all these guys are mining your data, your information, and trying to serve you ads that are appropriate to you, try to figure out what you're going to do next, what you want to like, what you will like. And there's a lot going on as it relates to just the gathering of data, so which results in new storage technologies and new databases, all the way up to new analytics to allow you to mine and explore that data and try to create, you know, actionable information out of that. The last one is software-defined networks or software-defined storage. It used to be, again, that we had dedicated boxes for networking equipment, dedicated boxes for storage. You know, now we're moving into an era where, again, the computing power is so becoming fast enough and high performance enough that you can actually run these types of applications and create these devices without special purpose hardware, and you can use generic hardware. And so you do it all in software to manage networks, to route information. When you go type in that URL over there, how do you get from there to there? You know, the systems that are in between are going to be disrupted by these software defined services. So now I'm going to transition a little bit and talk just about kind of, if you're starting a company and you're looking at a Series A opportunity, from my perspective, you know, what does that company need to really think about and do as they start to think about their business and their product? And I'm going to go through each one of these in detail, in a little more detail. But, you know, a lot of it is about, and I talked about it, touched on earlier, I just can't emphasize enough, getting customer feedback is so important. You know, borrowing experience, hiring smart people, patience, and you know, it's okay to fail, and again, putting the customer first from a point of view of customer satisfaction. Not to beat a dead horse here on when you think about building a product or a business, really focus on, you know, what does the customer want? You know, put things in front of them, figure out what they like and what they don't like, you know, and reiterate that back into the product. The more you can do that, the more customer validation you can get, the more likely it is that you'll be able to have something you can charge for, generate revenue, and you know, get investment dollars, and ultimately become a profitable company. In product development, it's this kind of idea of rapid prototyping. Don't go build something and put it in stone that you can't change it when you haven't gotten all the feedback that you need. So test and iterate and get the feedback, but don't don't solidify your product until you have the ability to, until you feel like you've gotten enough feedback on it. Borrowing experience. So what does this mean? It means, you know, talk to people who have been there and done it. You know, go to find people that, that can make introductions for you into businesses that might be your customers, you know, and just learn as much as you can from other people that have been there and done it and can help you and open doors for you. Again, it's just super important, you know, and it's sometimes a hard thing to do, but learning how to cold call people and ask for things is a great skill, but it's also a daunting thing to do sometimes, and it comes easier for others than some, and it's a really important skill just to be able to go out and really solicit feedback, and it's across everything. You know, how am I doing as a manager? How am I doing as a CEO? How do I find somebody that can tell me, you know, that I can learn from their mistakes as opposed to me having to make the mistakes myself? And again, you know, hire the smartest people you can. I mean, wouldn't you want, people that are smarter than you in any business that you're running? I mean, when I think about, entrepreneurs and people like that, I mean, I hope I'm backing, you know, people that I think are smarter and more capable and can execute better than I could. And I want them to go and hire, you know, the people. You know, you want to, you know, the idea should be, you know, hire the person that can come and replace you. The more people you can find like that, the better talent that you can find, you know, in general, the better the company will execute. And as I said it earlier, you know, ideas can be great. A lot of ideas fail just because of poor execution. They fail for other reasons too, but poor execution is one of them. And it's really important to, you know, hire the best people that you can. You know, patience is important, especially as it relates to, you know, your willingness to, it's okay to fail is really, the thing that I would say is that you're going to go out, you're going to try things, you're going to go do iterations with customer. The customer may not like something. You know, you got to come back and figure out what they like. You know, the company may not succeed in the end, but that's okay. You know, as long as you learn from your mistakes and are patient with yourselves and with the business as well. And lastly, you know, customer support is super important. You always want to, once you have a product, you've got to keep the customer happy, and you need to make sure that you're thinking about and responding to the customer and the customer needs, especially if you have a problem with your product. We have one of our portfolio companies, a company called Rackspace, out in Texas, and their whole tagline is fanatical customer support, and that's what they're known for, and that's why they keep customers, is because everybody that goes to them that's their customer realizes and has experienced just the fanatical customer support that they provide whenever there's a problem or if there's just getting them up and running, whatever it might be. And customer support is just super important as you think about, you know, once you start to get customers, you got to make sure you keep them happy and keep them as part of your business. You don't want to lose them. It's way easier to keep a customer than to go find a new one. So, and if you can sell more to that same customer you've got, that's even better. So in my last slide, and I think I'm kind of running on time here. My last slide is just some career advice from my experiences and just, you know, seeing other people. You know, the thing that I would say is, you know, actively manage your career. And what does that mean? It means that, you know, you should try to keep track of your successes, even the small ones, so that when you're in the organization that you're in, that you can, you know, sometimes remind your manager of the things that you've done that are good, you know, the successes that you've had. Because sometimes it's easy to forget, you know, like, you know, you did well on something and that was 6 months ago and your review is in another 6 months and, you know, nobody remembers when you have your review. So kind of keep track of your successes and remind, you know, your managers how you're doing. You know, and that's partly, you know, part of communicating up and down. You know, you want to be not only communicating to management, upper management, and trying to get that visibility, but you also have to be able to articulate yourself to, as you get further into your careers, to the people that work for you and engender you know, the respect and hopefully the leadership that they want to follow you and help you be successful. And of course, I can't emphasize enough, you know, always treat people with respect. You never know, it's a really small world, and you never know, you know, who's going to be the person that could get you next job, who could be your manager. You don't know. And I can tell you from my own experiences, you know, there are people that I went to school with when I was an undergrad, and I did not think very highly of them, but they've been super successful. And you know, having those relationships you know, maintaining them and maintaining a level of respect that they'll return your phone call if you ever call them. And if you ever need anything, or if they ever need anything from you, I just think you should always keep in mind how important it is to, you know, just treat people well, and you don't know where your next opportunity might come from. You know, in any job you pursue, in any company that you go to work for, I think it's really important to be, you know, you can go get a job. There's lots of jobs, certainly in technology, that are available today, but do something you're passionate about, because it makes your work experience a lot more fun and interesting if you do something that you're passionate about, that you have desire, that every day you wake up and you're really interested in that. When I went to work at Silicon Graphics, I was really excited about the technology and the things that we could do, that we could enable and visualize that you could never have visualized before. And that was really exciting, and I really liked that. And now in venture capital, I love working with entrepreneurs. I love looking at new businesses and new technologies, and I really enjoy that. You know, when I was at Rome, when I first started at Rome, one of the reasons why I left was I was on a product called, you know, phone mail, which is basically voicemail. And it's kind of, to me, it was kind of boring. You know, what, you know, switches can you integrate with and things like that? And I just wasn't really that passionate about it. So, you know, having a passion for what you do and the company you work for is important. You know, and part and parcel with that is you know, it's, you want to work with people that you think you can learn from, that you respect, and that you enjoy working with. And that also makes, you know, the work environment a lot more manageable and fun and everything else. So, you know, always try to find, you know, companies where you think you have a good cultural fit. And most importantly, I believe, you know, that you think you can learn from the people that are there, so that you can kind of progress in your career. And I kind of mentioned it earlier, which is kind of this treat people with respect, but nurture your network. You know, you have so many more tools available to you today than I ever had in college, with LinkedIn and Facebook and these types of things. You know, really, you know, nurture your network. You know, get to know the people that again, that could, you know, provide you a job somewhere in the future, or that you could be helping, that ultimately will come back to you is in karma points, however you want to think about it. But you know, nurture your network. You know, don't be afraid to you know, go to companies you know, even if they're not hiring, go ask them for a job, or go find somebody that's there and find out what's going on in that company if you're really passionate about what they're doing, and figure out how to network your way into things. It's you can get a lot done by working your network if you're really trying to get into, you know, whether it's into graduate school or into a certain business that you like. You know, there's usually there's somebody, you know, not too far removed from you that can help you get there. One or two people removed that you can get there through. So it's just an important thing. And then, you know, I would say, you know, this is one of the toughest things, is finding and creating, you know, kind of work-life balance. But it's, I think, an important thing to try to do. You know, some people are workaholics, some people aren't. But you always got to find the right balance of what works for you and you know, your family, if you have one, and making sure that you can strike the right balance to have both, you know, good career and a good, you know, home and social life as well. So, and that with that, I'll take any questions that people have.
Thanks, Mark.
So, guys, we only have one mic, so please be patient. You guys know we are filming this, so we want to try to get your question on air. So, first question.
Hi. Thank you for coming. My name is Amir. I'm also a double E major right now, and I'm really enthusiastic about starting a business, and I want to get into the business world, but I'm torn because I want to go to grad school also and get deeper into electrical engineering. So when you were in that position between undergrad and grad school, did you have any thoughts in that regards or any feelings or any insight on that?
I basically did my master's in my fifth year at Stanford. So I thought about it. But again, you know, the thing for me was I felt like I wanted to go deeper into the technology that I was interested in at the time. And that was one of the key reasons for staying and getting my master's. I think as you think about about what you want to do, I mean, you can always go back and get a master's if you're passionate about going to work now, going to work for a couple of years and getting some, applied experience can really be beneficial in some, when you go back to get your master's. You know, I used to always get irritated with, because we had in our master's program, there was always industry people that were also getting their master's. They were working at the same time. So they might have been at like HP or Intel or whatever. And they were never in the class. They always came in over the phone and they were watching it on video. And these guys knew so much more than I did because they had already been living it and working on it. And it used to just drive me nuts. You know, it's like, how can I compete with that? So I think, there's no right answer as to when, but I kind of feel like if you're passionate about something now, it's good to go, it's easier to kind of continue down the path of academia now than it is, kind of going out and then once you start getting a salary, having to go back to work and pay tuition and some of these other things, it can become difficult. So I don't have a good, there's no silver bullet answer as to what you should do. I mean, and I know people that have done, both ways and have all been successful.
Hey, Robert, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how and why you transitioned from engineering to product and marketing management at, was it Silicon Graphics?
Yeah. So one of the things I mentioned earlier was when I was getting my degrees in electrical engineering, I always kind of felt like I didn't feel like I wanted to be behind the computer coding or designing. And so I kind of have always had a passion to be more kind of customer oriented. And that's why I said like my first job, the reason why I took it, even though I wasn't as passionate about the technology as I was passionate about the job opportunity, which was in product planning, where I would have more input into what is the product, working, hearing customer feedback and those types of things. Ultimately, I didn't like the environment I was in, and so I left. And I went back to SGI, and the job they had for me was in engineering. But they knew because I told them when I was there that I really wanted to move into product management and marketing somewhere at some point in my career while I was there. And so, I was fortunate enough to be in an environment where, the company was growing rapidly. So there's lots of opportunities to move laterally and up so that's how I kind of got to there. But it's kind of always been my interest to be in the product management side as opposed to the pure engineering side.
I have another graduate school question. So as a person who's about to graduate from undergrad, but is torn between going to, say, a master's in engineering versus a MBA program. If you had any advice for that, and then kind of a quick follow-up of how practical an MBA is within the startup industry.
Yeah, so I think it's very different between getting your master's in electrical engineering or computer science or whatever other science discipline than going to get an MBA. I do think that in getting an MBA that you benefit a lot more out of your MBA by getting, you know, having had some work experience. And I know at Stanford, because I'm still fairly involved with the program there, they do take people out of undergrad directly, but usually those people have already started their own businesses and things like that when they were in undergrad. But more often than not, the bulk of the people that they admit are people that have worked, you know, 2, 4, or 5 years before before going back to get the MBA. So, and do I think an MBA helps with a startup? That's a good question. I think, you know, the one thing I've learned in venture capital is that for every rule that you create, there's an exception to every rule. So I can point to people that have been successful that shouldn't have ever been successful based on all the criteria that we think about and how we filter things. And then, you know, we've seen things where you have, you know, great CEOs, great product, and they still fail. So so it's a tough question to say, you know, does an MBA, I think an MBA helps from the point of view of thinking about how to build the business, you know, the business plan and think about those things. But you always have to be, more often than not, you know, couple, you know, the business person with the product or the engineering person. So I kind of think, you know, when we think about doing, you know, entrepreneurs in residence, one of the things we struggle with is, do we want the person that's the CEO or do we want the person who's the VP of engineering or CTO? Because usually the VP of engineering or CTO is the one that can go build the product, but they're not necessarily the ones that can always, you know, decipher the customer feedback and create the right product requirements. So it's a long answer to the question, which is, I think that an MBA is helpful, but it's by no means, you know, a ticket to say, you know, you're going to be successful in doing that. So,
Robert, you mentioned that the VC and angel industry is shrinking and it's getting small. It's pretty small. But how would an undergrad with an econ background really get into the VC industry? Do they have to go and work at like a tech startup first, or can they directly apply? Or what kind of analysts are you looking for pre-MBA?
So and I'll speak for Norwest because I can't speak for every other venture firm. But for us, when we hire an analyst, usually they're not fresh out of undergrad. They've usually worked for a couple years, typically in banking, where they've been, you know, learned how to, you know, do a spreadsheet like a video game, and then they come in. But the role for them is really, you know, kind of 2 years and out. You know, so when we hire those types of people, we're saying, you know, you come work with us for a couple of years, but after that, you know, you're expected to go back, either go into a startup or go into, you know, go back to business school or something like that, and then come out from there. The people that come in that we hire, they can kind of make it to the partner level, either have a lot of industry experience, or they have an MBA plus industry experience. So, you know, if you want to be in venture capital, I would suggest, you know, go work for a while, you know, in a tech. If you want to do tech, you got to be in tech. If you want to do healthcare, then go do healthcare. But yeah, I think you need work experience, and it always helps, again, in tech, I believe, to have a technical background, so that you can better understand some of the technologies that you're looking at, especially on the areas that I focus in, which is the enterprise-oriented things. Consumer and e-commerce, maybe less so, but those are also much more, you know, hit-driven types of businesses. You know, you look at things like Instagram and Snapchat and all these other things. You know, those were started out, and you know, there's probably 50 other companies that were like them that just never made it, you know, so it's hard to determine which one of those would be successful when you're, you know, kind of a priori, so.
Where do you see the next big trends from the internet coming? And I know social media sort of came by surprise and caught everyone by surprise, but I guess if you were looking at MySpace, you would have saw it coming. So do you have any MySpaces around?
I think the next big trends are going to be around more efficiency with, gaining more efficiency through mobile phones. How do I access more information? How do I make it easier to get at it? Today, people use multiple applications to try to do things on their phone. Can they do that with just one application, one focal point? I think the whole thing around big data, as I mentioned earlier, the analytics and the mining of all this information and data that Facebook's and retailers and everybody are collecting, I think is going to be an area. And as I said, the big disruption that's happening is as all this kind of compute and storage goes into the cloud, and it just keeps lowering the cost of what it takes to start and run a business. I think that you'll see a lot, a lot more new businesses being created, but also businesses that support how people use those technologies in the public cloud. I'm not visionary enough to say what the next Facebook is going to be or the next whatever it might be, because I think a lot of those things, as you mentioned, there was Friendster, if you guys remember that, and there was MySpace, and those kind of weren't successful, but Facebook somehow kind of ended up with the chemistry around being able to create the right solution at the right time. A lot of it has to do with market timing. You can't underestimate, great ideas that are too early to market, and then you see them 10 years later. When back in 99 and 2000, we all talked about the mobile web. It was called WAP, and it didn't materialize until 10 years later, when the iPhone basically came out, when you could really surf the web. And it's just the technology and the infrastructure that was underneath, and at the AT&T's and the Verizon's just really couldn't support the mobile web back when everybody wanted to do it, 13 years ago. So I don't know if I answered your question, but.
Okay, one more question in the back.
Hello. So just out of curiosity, being a venture capitalist, do you feel like there is another social media bubble in terms of how people are evaluating companies such as Instagram, Snapchat, or like Pinterest, how they're worth billions without really any revenue?
And these are one of these comments that I'll get in trouble for. I think that in the end, all these businesses will get valued based on kind of their ultimate ability to drive profits. And I think that Facebook is an example of something that got ahead of itself. It came back and corrected if you've looked at it in the stock market, but now it's back and past where it went public because they've been able to show and prove that they can generate, real revenue and real profit. And so these other ones, whether it's Pinterest or Snapchat or these other things, it's hard to know. There's a lot of momentum around these, and you might call it momentum investing in some ways, but there's a lot of momentum around them. It's hard to know, will they be able to, monetize that business in a time frame that allows the current valuations to continue to grow. When you get into businesses that are growing quickly, sometimes you have to pay a premium for them, hoping that they're going to grow through that premium and pass that valuation because they're going to generate that much more revenue and profit in the end. And so from that perspective, in any given time, it's hard to say, is this inflated or not? I don't know, I don't know the numbers for Pinterest. I don't know the numbers for Snapchat or these other things. A lot of people base it on user growth and just with the assumption that they'll be able to monetize at some point in time. And if they are right, then the valuations are probably justified. If they're wrong, then the valuations weren't justified and somebody's going to lose some money. So, but it's just hard to know. It feels like things are fully valued, but time will tell. So,
Roger.
Robert, thanks again
for coming down. We really appreciate you sharing your insights.
Thank you. Thank
you. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.